Okay, well, I just have to do a little horn tuning because I know Treasury Senator won't do it herself, but she,
here we go. We're coming apart.
But we've had fabulous news, and Carl can attest, so I brought it him to the meeting because he's our acting city manager. We had fabulous news. For years, Ms. Murkowski has been fighting with the Corps of Engineers on our behalf for setting aside a little pot of money for small places, less populated places like Alaska, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, American Samoa, places like that, that we cannot compete. Even the Port of Anchorage cannot compete against the Port of LA, the Port of Seattle, New York, all of these more populous places. And so she fought long and hard, and a lot of us were right there behind her, supporting this this program called the Section 107, of which they set aside between $20 and $30 million for international dredge projects in these small places, of which the North Harbor qualified for the second second dredge project in the entire country. So we have her to thank for our news. I, of course, went championing the cause for the South Harbor. And I was told right off the bat that GLO, you're out of luck. It's a state run harbor. It was state built in 64 when the Corps identified a possible new harbor for Petersburg. They actually suggested that the South Harbor area would be perfect, but the state and its wisdom, and we were pretty cash rich during the 70s and 80s, they decided to come in and build it ourselves. And so the Corps stepped back and let us do it. And so therefore, now here we are, 30-some years later, and we're seeing signs of glacial rebound and the siltation and things, and Gary can attest to this, and Clyde can attest to this. These guys are going to ground now because of the South Harbor Basin. So once again, Ms. Murkowski has stepped up to the plate, and she made sure that Section 107 has been fully supported, and she got us eligibility for the South Harbor. And I don't know how she did it, and I'm not asking any questions, but I have. Carl was there. I had a teleconference with the Corps of Engineers on Friday that they said, by golly, GLO, you see federal interest, we're willing to come in, and if you commit to 50% of the feasibility study, we see not only viability for the federal Corps to come in and split the dredge 50-50 with us, they also see the future of they taking maintenance responsibility for the entire basin. So 20 years from now, when we have to do the southern end of the South Harbor, they're going to pick up 100% staff.
Wow.
Whoa. Even more, they've said that through this study, feasibility study, they see that Petersburg probably will most likely see the potential for a new harbor, which they will help us identify, and they will come in and prepare the basin, bring waters, those kind of stuff, those kind of things for a harbor of the future. So, wow. I mean, the longevity of our community is really, really, has turned a corner, I think. And I burst into tears. I'm so thrilled about it. So, anyway, with that, huge round of applause. Thank you so much for coming to Petersburg, and we hope we get to see you again for the big election.
Thank you. Yeah. Description of Section 107. That was going to put most people to sleep. We know how to make this lady happy. Just a little bit of dredging and she's a happy woman. But this is what makes the job that I have as your representative in the United States Senate so fabulous. Because it is these opportunities, it's these opportunities that are not making national news, Nobody in Philadelphia at the Democratic Convention or nobody in Cleveland at the Republican Convention last week was talking about what's going on with harbors in Petersburg, Alaska. They were talking about stuff that is, I guess it's important in the bigger scheme of things, but at the end of the day, so much of what I do to represent you in Washington is the things that don't make the national news. In fact, they might not make the Alaska Dispatch. I bet that this didn't make the Dispatch. But you've got your local reporters here that are covering the things that are important to you and your community. And so, whether it's what we can help facilitate through a stronger local economy so that your fishermen can move in and out so that you can move your fish in an expedient way, this is the best part of the job that we do. There's a lot of discussion about what is happening, or more importantly, what is not happening in Washington, D.C. The news that you will receive is that it's gridlock, it's tension, it's bickering, nothing is happening, kind of throw the bums all out. And there is that, there's that national just urge right now. I'm going to take just a couple minutes this afternoon before we turn to questions and give you a little bit of hope about a process that most people describe as just inherently broken and ugly and just ineffective. At a time when we are in the midst of a very difficult election politically and just in terms of where people are lining up on opposite extremes, the Senate has actually been producing some things. We don't get a lot of coverage about it because it's actually good news, and good news is not very interesting to cover. But we've had an opportunity to get rid of a 10-year education bill called No Child Left Behind that was leaving lots of kids behind, and particularly in a state like Alaska where a one-size-fits-all application really just doesn't work for us. And so we got rid of it, and we put in place legislation called Every Student Succeeds. Why we name them these goofy names, I don't know. What I do hope we take away from this is a reform that really moves us from the Washington, D.C. school board that we've had for the past 10 years to putting that control to the local level so that your local superintendents here, your school boards, your educators, your parents are weighing in as part of this process and saying what we expect for our kids within our schools. And we passed that. President signed into law. There was a good news story for about one day, and then boom, we move on. So what else have we been doing? We passed an FAA reauthorization. That's pretty important for us here in the state of Alaska as we fly everywhere. Transportation. Where's my ferry t-shirt gal that was here earlier? She came in and she says, "This is why I'm here. Support the ferries." And we know here in Southeast that this is our marine highway. This is highway that deserves to be funded just like the highways up in South Central. No different, except one's a little more liquid than the other. And what we have done is we put in place a 6-year highway bill. We haven't had a multi-year highway bill in 10 years. So when we're talking public works, when we're talking about roads, you need to know that you've got money beyond this fiscal year. It's going to make a difference. I'm getting all choked up.
I think I might have to sneeze 3 times to get it out.
I was in a really big parade in Fairbanks. 3-mile parade. 3-mile parade. And I run run back and forth, so it was probably a 7-mile parade for me. But in addition, we had all of these chants and sharing going on. And I lost my voice. So I think I'm dealing with that as well as a bone leg. But transportation bill. A 6-year predictable path for formula funding for not only the state of Alaska, but all the states. And with Alaska and the way that we receive our formula funds, there's an increase every year for the next 6 years that we can count on. That's pretty important to us. So that passed, nobody really paid much attention except for the guys that are trying to plan, and they're pretty excited about that. I'm hoping that somebody will give me a little bit of a preview of what you're facing here in Petersburg when it comes to drugs. It wasn't more than a couple visits ago that I sat down with your chief of police, we sat down with some folks with the U.S. Postal Service, with the FBI, because we were concerned about meth coming into Petersburg and how we were going to cut that off and how we were going to deal with things. We made some headway there with the sting operation some years ago. But now what we're dealing with across the country is an opioid addiction that is horrible, and it is bringing full communities to their knees. We passed an opioid abuse bill just a few weeks ago to be focused in on this scourge that we're seeing around the country. I'm the chairman of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. We've been working on an energy bill now for the past about a year and a half since I've been chairing the committee. My partner on the Energy Committee is Senator Cantwell from Washington State. Her politics are a little bit different than mine. In fact, they're so different than mine that when it was known what the pairing was going to be on that committee, we were basically written off by people in Washington, D.C., saying the politics between Murkowski and Cantwell are just too deep on energy issues. Don't count on much from this committee. Well, we said, look, we haven't done an energy bill in almost 10 years. And it was a very frank conversation where I said, I think that we need to reform our policies. I think we need to update them. There's going to be some things that I support that you can't. I'll put them off the table. I'll just say we won't even go there. But you've got some things that you feel strongly about that I can't support. So let's agree to put them off the table there. And let's focus on the 80%. And so we said, yeah. And from that process, we built an energy bill that not only moved through the committee on a very strong bipartisan vote, but we moved it through the floor of the United States Senate with 85 members supporting us. And we did that in April of this year when everybody said, legislation is dead, particularly anything that is considered reform legislation. It just can't happen. And then they said, well, we don't need to worry about that because they'll never be able to get it to conference. Because the House took a very, very, very different approach. They took a very partisan approach to energy legislation. They said, never going to happen. We were able to get a vote to go to conference with only three folks opposing us. So I say this because it is important to know that there is work that is being done. And it's not just kind of the naming of the post offices. I think we've actually stopped doing that. But it's not easy. We're going to be going back in September for another 5 weeks, and then it will be a month before the election, and we'll be going back in to kind of clean up the business at the end of the year. But I want you to know that even though the process is sometimes really foul out there, that there are good, committed people who are committed to working across the aisle, because that's the only way that anything gets done. It's just not possible otherwise. So I can go on all afternoon until my throat wears out. But I'd rather hear questions from you. We had a good discussion with a couple of you talking about the transboundary issue. I'd be happy to share more of that conversation. I know we've got the superintendent here. We've got people from, well, we had people from the hospital here, right here. So really, it's your time to either ask questions of me to get further update or to update me on the things that are important to you here in Petersburg. So the floor is yours, and I throw it out to you. Who's going to start us off?
I will.
Barbara. Oh, you don't need to stand.
Oh, good. Thank you. I have three questions. The first one is, where is the energy bill now? Has it gone through conference? I wanted to thank you for the work you have done in the Arctic and icebreakers, and I don't know where that stands either at this point. And you answered a letter that I wrote back in August, and I wanted to thank you for that, and we can discuss that later.
As far as where the energy bill is, we voted to go to conference just before we left a couple weeks ago. So what is happening now is staff for all of the conferees on both the House and the Senate side are sitting down, and they're basically doing side-by-sides, looking to where the differences are between the House version and the Senate version. So they're basically doing the analysis and the comparison so that when we get back right after Labor Day, the members will sit down and say, okay, this bucket right here are things that we agree on because it's in both versions. This is a more difficult bucket, and this is the one that's really going to require some navigation. So that's kind of where we are in that process. Arctic. You may feel like you're a long way from the Arctic here in Petersburg, but really not so much. Alaska makes the United States an Arctic nation. But having acknowledged that, saying that, doesn't really put you in the game if you don't have the resources. And when I say resources, it's not just icebreakers. We lack certain infrastructure. We lack a deep water port north of Dutch Harbor. It's a long way from Dutch Harbor up to the Beaufort and the Chukchi. It's a long way for that Coast Guard cutter, whether it is a national security cutter that I would like to have home ported in Kodiak, or the helicopters that need to provide search and rescue. So making sure that we've got investments in infrastructure is key. So we've got an effort underway to really kind of be focused on not a series of ports, because that makes it sound too big. We're going to need more than one. Nome is looking to be that first deep water port there, but that's a lot of space to cover. It's 1,100 miles. So we've got a lot of work to be doing with that. And some of it is just basic. It's mapping. It's charting. It's understanding what the bottom of the floor looks like, the seafloor looks like. So whether it's what you're facing here in Petersburg or up north, we need to know. And we haven't done those basic charts. So we're spending a lot of focus and energy on that. It has been described, the Arctic has been described as like discovering a new ocean on planet Earth. And it should be exciting to us all. There's commercial opportunities. You've got the Crystal Serenity that's going to be moving from Seward through the Aleutians and then on up over the top and ending up in New York, a three-week journey that everyone's going to be watching. It's a 1,000-passenger ship. So search and rescue needs to be something that is in place. Telecommunications needs to be something that is in place. Now, the Celebrity, the Crystal Serenity, will have kind of its own complement going up with it. But what about next year? Who's going to be making sure that you've got that capability, that capacity following that next leadership up. So when we talk about infrastructure, we need to have the assets. We've got money in the appropriations budget for an icebreaker. I don't know if we're going to be able to keep the full $1 billion, because that's what it's going to take, is $1 billion, that's with a B, $1 billion for an icebreaker, and costs about 10 years to build. You say, well, it's a good thing we have other icebreakers in the fleet. Yeah. Let me tell you about the other icebreakers. One of them is sitting at dock in Seattle, and she will never leave that dock again. She's been cannibalized. For you mariners, you would cry if you go in the belly of that boat. It's horrible. It's just, she's done. And then where is the Polar Star? She's on assignment to Antarctica. You're saying, okay, well, she'll come back. No, she won't. She breaks ice in McMurdo, down in the South Pole, for 6 months. And then she needs to come back to the United States to basically be kind of scrubbed and painted and refitted again, so that she can go back for yet another breakout next year. We will never see her in the Arctic. She's fully committed. And by the way, she's got a useful life of somewhere between 5 and 7 years now, because she's already been rehabbed once. So when we talk about our fleet, our ice-breaking fleet, we have the Healy, which is a medium-strength research vessel. And she's a great little ship, but that's not an icebreaker fleet. Russia's got 44, China's building 6, India's looking at building 1. Where are we? I can talk about the Arctic a lot. What else is on anybody's mind? Cynthia.
So I have two things. One, I was wondering if you would give a genetically engineered salmon puppy. And then we were talking before we all sat down about transboundary. And, you know, again, I just wanted to thank you for all the work you're doing. I'm here representing United Southeast Alaska Gill Netters Association, and we're fishing from Haines to Ketchikan. And along with Petersburg, this is a really important issue for us to protect our waters. And you've just done so much for that. And I appreciate you being willing to meet with Lieutenant Governor again about that. So if you don't mind just sharing some of those things.
Let's talk about GE salmon first. This is, you use the proper term, genetically engineered salmon. It makes it sound acceptable because, you know, we're in such a high-tech world. So I usually just call it frankenfish and usually scowl and sneer when I say it. You know, FDA has signed off on the Aqua Bounty application, allowing them to proceed with what I call a science experiment. A science experiment at the expense of our wild healthy stocks, and potentially at the expense of the jobs and livelihoods of our fishermen. And so I've tried to lay my body down in front of the train on multiple occasions, and FDA it went ahead and signed off. And what they've signed off on is an approval that allows for this DNA from an eel pout to be spliced with an Atlantic salmon into a Chinook, so that it causes this fry and ultimately the fish itself to grow at twice the rate of an average fish. They tell us, you don't need to worry about this fish escaping. You don't need to worry. We're going to make sure that they're sterile. You don't need to worry. You don't need to worry. I worry. I worry, and I will worry until we have absolutely shut it off and killed it. When they say, well, this is going to help with American jobs, they forget to tell you that, well, we're going to be going to be hatching, or the eggs will be in coming out of Nova Scotia, and they will be raised in pens in Panama. So last I checked, Nova Scotia nor Panama were part of the United States, so I'm not quite sure where we get the American jobs there. But I do worry that they will continue the effort, and when if the effort is successful, there will be another genetically engineered fish that will follow it. What's it going to be? I don't know. But I'm not willing to take the risk. So what we have done is we've included language in two different appropriations bills. We've got language that we have introduced by way of law that basically says you cannot provide for any of these fish to come into this country until there has been mandatory labeling. FDA came back and said, well, we're not going to do the mandatory labeling, but we'll allow for voluntary labeling. Now, who is going to slap a label on a fish that says, this is not the real thing? Nobody. So we have at least stuck them with the requirement for mandatory labeling if we get to that point that they are able to actually bring it into the country. So I'm taking this one bite at a time to make sure that there is no easy path forward, because I believe very, very strongly that this will be a hit to our fishermen. And again, things that swim, that know no fences, are a threat. And I'm just not willing to back down off that. So we continue to push, continue to fight on that. We've made some good headway, but we still got the battle in front of us. On transboundary, another issue that could pose a threat to the strength of our healthy fisheries within this area. Several years back, when we had the Mount Holly failure, it kind of woke everybody up to the fact that you've got a lot of mining operations that are not necessarily in this country, where we can kind of keep an eye on them and know what the permits are, what the regulations are, what the cleanup is. It's in another country. But the potential for impact to come downstream into our waters, impact our fishery, is real. And so that was a real wake-up call for so many of us. And so I engaged in that early on, asking about this International Boundary Commission as a process, so that we could understand that there was actually some discussion going back and forth between the United States and Canada on these important transboundary issues. And long story short, the State Department has taken a very hands-off approach, and I think part of this was trying to deal with the politics of Canada. They had things going on at that time with Harper that were perhaps not as good as they would want, and they're trying to kind of keep peace on different issues. So for a host of different reasons, state just was not engaging. Walker Mulott come into office. The lieutenant governor is tasked with really taking this on, working with the minister over in British Columbia. I think he did make some headway. I think he did open up some eyes. Memorandum of agreement is entered into. I've had many, many conversations, not only with the governor, but the lieutenant governor on this. I brought the other members of the delegation with me to say, look, we need to be united as an Alaska delegation when we go to the State Department, telling them that this is an issue that needs to be elevated, and it needs to be elevated to these high levels, and you can do this through this commission. So we are going to continue to keep that pressure to elevate this, and as we discussed briefly in our conversation, it looks like the state is willing to perhaps join the delegation with a stronger push to state. I think that may help us. I don't want this to be elevated because we're responding to an incident. We've got an opportunity to be proactive instead of reactive. One of the things that I have done as the chairman of the Interior Appropriations Committee is make sure that we inserted money in the budget to provide for some baseline fund, baseline data so that we understand what's going on with our waterways. So in the horrible chance that something should happen, we know what we've got, we know what we started out with. So we're working it on multiple fronts, but I will tell you, the very united voices coming out of Southeast, from the various fishing groups, from the communities, from the councils, this has been helpful to us as we put those packets together to deliver to state. So thank you for doing so much of the legwork for us so that we can let people know that this is important. People will tell you, they'll come up and say, Lisa, I thought you supported mining. I do support mining. I support resource development. But I also support it with a level of regulation that we can rely on. And I'm not saying that we don't trust the Canadians, but I don't. I don't know what the Canadians are doing over there. So let's not be in a situation where we're caught blindsided. So thanks for your help on this. My answers are too long. I'm going to try to shorten them up. Everyone's afraid to ask a question because they're like, oh gosh, she's going to go on forever and ever. Yes, go ahead.
I have a hard question for you. My family fishes. We rely on fishing just about 100% for our income. My two sons and a granddaughter, and I'm worried about her future. Immediately after passage of the Sea Alaska Bill in late 2014, you declared, and this is a quote, some 43 years after passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the federal government will finally finish paying the debt we owe natives for the settlement of their Aboriginal land claims. As many predicted, passage of the Sea Alaska Bill opened a Pandora's box. Only 3 months after you made that statement, you introduced more native land legislation and more recently, kind of a revised version of that, and another bill, I kind of call it your wish list, the Alaska Economic Development and Access to Resources Act. These bills would result in transfer of thousands of acres of federal land for privatization, creation of a 2 million acre state forest, mine development for rare earth minerals, and believe me, all Alaska mining projects are not clean and green, numerous oil-related giveaways, and would even allow Cook Inlet Regional Corporation to select additional acreage anywhere in the state. You've remained largely silent on these vitally important bills affecting all Alaskans. What is needed is a public discourse on them. And I have three questions for you. The first being, when will you schedule field hearings? And have maps been presented to you for these selections? And if so, when will you make them publicly available on your website? And how about 100-foot buffers? And I have to tell you, last October, I did an overflight of the mainland and Prince Wales Island, and it was unbelievable. I am probably permanently affected by that. Cleveland Peninsula is leveled from saltwater to alpine. Headwater streams, these are the class 4 streams, are gone, or you know, have been completely cut. And that was under those lands, they're recently logged, but those were under the original ANGSA. And now I understand that they're logging right next door to that, so it'll just be even, it's massive. In fact, I would call it landscape genocide on a massive scale. And they're logging right next to that. It will continue that. It will be conversion to a colonial-style tree plantation, and that's just one area. Prince Wales has been pretty hard hit. And so you're proposing more land selections. You want to privatize. We all know that private state forest practices act is far weaker than federal, those pesky federal regulations. There are no provisions for wildlife. There are minimal protections for fish streams, and I really think we need some field hearings on this, and not during the work season.
Well, as far as timing of some of the issues that you have raised, the second week in July, I introduced a package of Alaska bills, and you have referenced them as the Alaska Economic Package or the wish list or what have you. They have not had any hearing yet. What I wanted to do was introduce these provisions, put them out on the table so that Alaskans could see them just as you have, digest them, fret and fume over them, celebrate them, whatever, but have that opportunity to look at what I am proposing, what I am suggesting. What I would hope that we would be able to do is have preliminary hearings on them in September when we return to Congress. But I recognize that we've got a very brief window there. But what I want to make sure is that there is a process, so that there is that discussion, so that when we sit down and we talk about areas or maps, that there has been that discussion. I am not one who wants to operate or who will operate with just myself in a closed door, put the bill down and say, well, okay, I'm the chairman of the committee, we can make this happen. I'm not going to do that. As you will recall, we spent years, and I don't remember how many different iterations of how many different maps, working through the Sea Alaska legislation. Now, some may not like the final selections, but the reality with Sea Alaska, as is the reality with the landless communities that we have provided for in this bill, the Native veteran provision that we have provided for in a subsequent bill, these are commitments that have been made historically that have not been honored. And so whether it was Sea Alaska and making sure that they received their final entitlement, or whether it is SERI able to receive their last few 10,000 acres, I want to make sure that we honor that commitment. This is hard because every acre in Alaska is precious to somebody. I respect that, but I also respect that as a state, we need to get our land conveyance issues resolved. We've been a state now for 57, 59 years, whatever it is. We have commitments that have been made under ANCSA that need to be honored. And so, as difficult as it is, I want to begin that process. And so, I'm putting them out there on the table, and I am willing to sit down in community meetings, in field hearings, in town halls, to gain just this kind of input. But talking about what it is that we can do to provide for not only the commitment, but when you think about those who will object to federal lands being conveyed to Native people, and there's a fear that they might use it for some economic gain, That's kind of hard for me. As much as I want to make sure that all of our economies are strong, I'm not one that believes that the best path forward for the state of Alaska is that the federal government manage all of our lands. They've already got 62% that they manage. So I want to make sure that we honor the commitments that have been made, and I'm willing to get in the room with people and work through the difficult discussions, talk about things like stream buffer, making sure that again, we're honoring not only the commitments, but that we're honoring the landscapes and the environment. We all choose to call this place home. I don't think that there's anybody that thinks it's in a community's best interest or the state's best interest that we rape, pillage, and ruin. That's not in anyone's interest. So making sure that we're able to develop our resources, but do it in a way that is consistent with our environment, consistent with who we are as Alaskans. This is what we're trying to do. So I'm going to start that process, and I welcome this type of engagement. So I appreciate that.
My question would be somewhat of the same thing on the resource. I think of Alaska, with all of our waterways, we have still a pretty good potential for tidal energy development. And do you have any information, because we think of south of Craig is Skookumchuck, you've got Tongass Narrows, you've got Wrangell Narrows, you've got Kutznuhu and Mangoon. Is there some real feasibility and some potential for helping small communities develop from tidal, or for that matter, you can also touch on more hydro things. We know they're desperately expensive, but it seems like tidal is something that we should have been moving earlier on.
Well, I happen to think that tidal, marine hydrokinetic, ocean energy, this is exciting stuff for a state like Alaska, and particularly small coastal communities that far too many of them are still reliant on diesel. It's a bad option. It's not good for a host of different reasons. So you think about the energy that you've got and the predictability.
Yep.
You know, one of the things that we talk about with renewables is, well, they're intermittent. Well, tides,
yep,
we're publishing the book a year in advance. So we got so much potential there. Within this energy bill that we're moving through the process now, we've got a couple provisions, a couple titles that I think will be very, very helpful to us as we develop our marine hydrokinetic or tidal or all our ocean energy and all aspects of hydro. So it highlights that there are opportunities not only for funding, but the assessments, the analysis that come with. In addition, we've got a provision in the bill that will help a state like Alaska. As you'll recall, we have a renewable energy fund here. Well, state renewable energy fund is only as good as a legislature puts money into it. Because if there's nothing into it, there's nothing to take out. And right now, I'm not quite sure what's in it, but there's probably not enough to even do a feasibility study. So what we have done in the energy bill is we make allowance for the states to tap into the renewable energy grant funding on the federal end. So it's something that currently we can't do. We have to come up with our own resources. So it would allow for communities, whether it's Angoon with what's going on at Kutznuhu or wherever, it would allow for us to tap into federal monies just kind of bypassing through the state. So for us, and some of the smaller projects that we have, what we've structured is an opportunity to access federal dollars that we haven't been able to. There's some exciting projects that are going on around the state right now when it comes to marine hydrokinetic. There's a river turbine in just outside of Igigig. Maybe it's Igigigig. It's Igigigig. And what they're able to do with their current coming from the river, combined with two wind turbines and a couple solar panels, they're getting that community completely off their diesel. Yakutat is looking at some serious wave energy projects, and they're partnering with an outfit from Maine, which is, there's still a ways off. It's extraordinary to me, recognizing that about 70% of the planet Earth is water. It's amazing to me that we have done as little as we have when it comes to harnessing the energy from the ocean. Another piece that we have in the energy bill that impacts us down here in Southeast is the support for hydropower. We still, in our federal policies, do not recognize hydropower as a renewable energy resource. We changed that, and by changing that, we also allow hydro to be the beneficiary of some of the renewable energy tax credits. Right now, we have a relicensing that is going on around the country with all of our hydro. And we're not talking Bonneville Power Hydro. We're talking about, you know, Tyee, we're talking about Mahoney. Do you realize that on average, it takes 10 years and up to $50 million to re-license a hydro facility? An existing facility, we're not talking about doing anything new. Not doing anything new. So we've got a very considered look at how we deal with hydropower in this country. Because you're not going to see big dams coming up in the lower 48. You're not going to see, you know, so sitting in the governor, pull the plug on that. It's been pulled many times. But what you're going to see in Alaska is more of what we have down here in your region, which are the smaller projects that will allow for a level of intertie that makes sense. And when you think about the benefits that we see from hydropower, when you think about what we can tap into for ocean energy, I think it's pretty exciting. I think it's pretty exciting. It will change the viability of our smaller communities. And as I go around the state, this is the weak spot in our state for our high energy costs. And what do you do? What do you do if you are a little coastal community that was in the mouth of the Yukon a couple days ago? If your energy costs are so high that you cannot afford to make ice to keep your fish cold so that people will deliver to your village, you don't have an economy. So these microgrid solutions that we're looking at that will allow us to take a little bit of wind and hook it into a little bit of a stream flow and hook it into a little bit of solar. Solar has an awful lot of application in Alaska. We don't think about that, but we really do. The biomass projects that we're seeing here in Southeast with waste heat, there's some innovation going on that's being led by Alaskans that the rest of the country is looking at and saying, how'd you guys do that? So we're being pretty pioneering here, and it's a good thing.
So I have a question just a comment that ties into the cost of living point that you made. I'm on the Borough Assembly. We're very concerned about reauthorization of secure rural schools, particularly in this Alaska economic climate. The per capita inclusion in the formula, it works against Petersburg. We're a relatively affluent community. However, we feel that the cost of living for state of Alaska residents overall should be considered in that SRS formula. And so we would ask you to change
that. Well, is it not? I thought that Alaska's, that it was not only cost of living for the community, but that the state cost of living was also factored in.
My understanding is that's not the case.
Okay.
And I was asked actually to bring that point forward to you. So that
well,
is
I will look at that because, as you know, secure rural schools has just been a panic attack every year, and right now it's on the glide path out. It's been on the glide path out for a while. We did. I don't think that Petersburg. You don't get any. What do you get from PILT? Do you get anything?
$600,000.
Yeah. PILT, we've taken care of this year. We've actually plussed up PILT for the first time in decades. So there will be more coming just kind of across the board. We haven't figured out what that's going to mean for the respective communities. But secure rural schools has been our big fight because, unfortunately, there's just such a small number of states that rely on this secure rural schools funding. When we're trying to gain advocates from other states, they're saying, we don't understand why you have this in the first place. And, oh, by the way, wasn't this supposed to be a temporary program that allows you to kind of get back on your feet after a timber industry has moved on. And when you tell people, well, what do you do in a community like Petersburg or Wrangell or Ketchikan that is in the heart of a national forest? It's not like you can just go out there and start something new. And so our fight is a difficult one with secure rural schools. But we've got some key allies. It fortunately is a bipartisan fight, which has allowed us to stay in the game. But I'll look into that cost of living aspect of it, because maybe I could just assume that that was factored in. We should never make assumptions that way. So I will look into it, and we'll report.
My only other comment, and this is a personal one, is I wish that there was a special provision in that highway bill for transportation that's water-based, because what happens is all of that funding goes toward roads in Alaska, and our scenic byway that is our lifeblood and our lifeline gets shortchanged.
We have funding in the highway bill for ferries, but as I was explaining to somebody earlier, it will help you with your infrastructure, but operation and maintenance, you know, nothing. So, you know, we will upgrade the highway going up to Fairbanks, and we'll fill in potholes, and we'll take away the frost heaves. But that operation and maintenance is good as long as it stays steady. And this is again been a struggle for us. This is where Patty Murray from Washington State and I have really tried to change the thinking on this. This was some years back when we were working once again on a highway bill, and I said, you know, it's so important for the ferry system. And the response that I had was, I don't understand why we should have to help Alaska out with its cruise operations. And you have to kind of walk them through, this is not how we get around for vacation. This is how we move our goods. It's how we move our kids who are attending basketball games. It's how we travel.
And it's how sustainable Alaska moves their equipment from community to community to work on projects.
But I will tell you, and I'm not telling you anything that you don't know, but it needs to be reinforced. Far too many Alaskans, of the 720,000 Alaskans that call this place home now, have never been to Southeast, have no idea what the Alaska Marine Highway System is. They don't, when we talk about ferries, they think it's pixie dust. They don't know. And so when your legislators are advocating for more support, they get kind of this blank look, like, yeah, why are we funding the cruise lines? And so this is something where internally, as Alaskans, we need to be figuring out how we can better communicate this as an issue to people around the rest of the state. Because those rail belt lawmakers, they're just representing their constituents. And I say that because I used to be an Anchorage area legislator, but having grown up here and knowing and understanding that this is the lifeline, I get it, but there are far too many people that fly straight from Anchorage to Seattle, and this is just another place on the map that they'll never go to. We need to do a better job. And as we look at the demographics of the state and how people are moving and where the centers of population are, you know what's happening with your own representation through redistricting. You can't get more lawmakers if you don't have more people. But then you can't get more people if you don't have a way to get around.
Yeah.
So,
I actually invited our chief here, and just to
all right, chief.
Visit with you a little bit about the drug issue. It's kind of a hot topic, I'm sure, everywhere, but it's an especially hot topic, made the newspaper here, about kind of our issues. So,
I would really appreciate it if you would update me. I'm happy to share the mic with you.
Sure. I appreciate you having me.
I understand you're working on a new building up there.
We are ready for a level 6.
About dang time.
So we do have some challenges, particularly with heroin and methamphetamine. And the problem is not something that we in law enforcement can solve on our own. I'm sure you're aware that we deal with the criminal part of the problem, but we also need to make sure that we have services in place to help these addicts. So we've got plenty of demand here, and the Lower 48 has plenty of supply. So I would like to come up with a solution where we can hit this problem from many different angles to make sure that we're holding the mid and higher level dealers that are supplying our communities with these drugs accountable, and that the addicts are getting the help they need to beat the addiction. So one of the problems we have from a law enforcement standpoint with supply and demand is heroin, for example, is sold in tenths of a gram. A gram is about the size of a sugar packet, a sweetener that you get at a restaurant. So each one of those little packets has 10 dosage uses of heroin. That heroin can be bought in the Lower 48 for as little as $4 a dose, up to $22 a dose. That same dosage rated here, depending on the supply and demand, can sell for about $35 up to $100. So for a very little investment, these dealers can buy a significant quantity of these controlled substances and bring them into our community to distribute. It's coming in any way goods and services that people come in. We get it through the mail, we get it on the ferry system, we get it through Alaska Airlines, we get it through the barge line. So it's a problem that we have, and even though our quality of life is very good here, there's room for improvement, and we'd like to come up with a solution that help maintain and improve that quality of life.
It's sobering.
There you go.
Chief, I don't think you were in the room yet, but I mentioned that we did just pass a bill that we call the CARA bill, but it focuses on opioid abuse education, prevention, how we can, those who have overdosed, how we can save their lives, but also on the treatment side. So it was a significant effort in that it was the first really big legislative effort that we have seen. The president has signed it, but in my view, it is just the first step in recognizing that we have a very serious problem. Not only in Alaska, where unfortunately we're seeing opioid abuse and deaths at an average that is greater, and some are saying twice as high as the national average. But part of our issue is we don't have treatment facilities. And the ease with which people become addicted and then no place to go. There's no place to go in the state. You can't afford to go outside. And so you don't get the care and the help that you need. I would really love to sit down with you about some specifics as to how we can keep it from coming into our communities. I used to think that if a state is far enough away off the grid, you know, we're not on anybody's transportation grid like you have in the Lower 48. You're an island here, for heaven's sakes. There ought to be a way that we can contain this. And when we were dealing with this meth issue some years ago and trying to figure out, we knew where it was coming from in California. We knew who was sending it, who was receiving it, and we just had logistical issues. You know, how you get that warrant issued, how you got a judge basically on standby to be doing all of this, the series of steps that had to be taken to deal with a simple, not necessarily simple, but the arrest of those that are involved. So I do think that this is something that, as a state, we need to be looking critically at not only how we deal with those who face this level of addiction, unprecedented levels of addiction, but how we engage at the front end from keeping it from hitting the streets and our people in the first place. Next Thursday, I believe it is, it's the 4th of August, Senator Sullivan has organized he's calling it a wellness summit, but he's bringing in the head of the Drug Enforcement, it's the head of the DEA, but he's also got the drug czar, and I can't remember who the drug czar is. You know. Anyway, he's convening a significant gathering of people from the lower 48, from the administration, in concert with people in Alaska to kind of shine a spotlight on our specific problems. But I do hope that it's the beginning of some very serious action plans for how we're dealing with this. Because I'm having people coming up to me at public gatherings saying, is there any way that you can get my daughter into treatment? The only place that I feel that she is safe is when she's in jail. And I'm not telling stories that you don't know. So we've got a problem, folks. And the scary thing is, this is not kind of the spacey, kind of stereotype drug addict that you might think. These are women in their 40s who are professionals. These are college graduates, young men that get up every day and go to work and perform, and then in the evening can't function. These are kids. And it's crossing socioeconomic boundaries, all demographics, out in the villages, in the urban centers. And we're not immune from it. So I really would like to visit with you a little bit more about ways that we can work to intercept, because if we can cut it off at its source, and again, when something is so inexpensive,
it just seems like with the Homeland Security in force here, we have such a presence, even our tiny little airport. If they could juggle both jobs, I mean, you know, we're searching for those terrorists and we're, you know, here in Petersburg, but we have 3-4 federal workers up there that you wish they had a dual job. But so many times in this country we find it, identify a problem, that's my job, and that's outside of my job description. And it just seems like here in our tiny little state that, you know, those kind of people could be used in multiple capacities.
I don't disagree. Chief, you want to add anything?
Well, I was just going to mention add a little bit to what Glow said. I think that this is a global problem or a national problem, and we tend to look at it from a global standpoint. But I really think it's going to take a local solution to solve it. It's going to have, we tend to hit things from the top down, but we really need to kind of hit this, I think, from the bottom up. It's hard to cut off that supply when it's so readily available in the lower 48. So, you know, we really have to work on our demand reduction and cutting off the supply units and supporting these addicts, because, you know, one of the areas that we're really weak on is just infrastructure. Alaska has such a small population base, and we're spread out over this huge geographic area that it's hard to have all this infrastructure in place, you know, to accomplish these goals.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'll get out of your hair now.
No. What else is out there? I haven't been ignoring this side of the room here. Don't think that just this group gets to ask the questions. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sure I am speaking for many tribal members
who applaud your continued efforts with the landless bill. There seems to be a misunderstanding, or I have felt that there has been a misunderstanding, that it is truly what you say, a commitment in honoring ANCSCA, what was provided through ANCSCA. I do know that there are many projects that have been provided for through our local tribal government in Petersburg Indian Association in enhancing and creating recreational areas that benefit all the citizens of Petersburg. And I just wanted to thank you and applaud you again for your continued efforts in addressing landless and that all it stands for.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We'll keep working at it. What else is out there? You don't ask questions, we're going to make you eat food.
I'm here representing the Petersburg Vessel Owners, and we'd like to thank you for working on the genetically modified salmon issue. I know you must be a little bit down about it right now, but we're proud of the fact that you've stuck with it and that you're going to continue to stick with it. I just don't think there's any, we could talk about what a bad idea it is all day long, each room, but anyway, thank you so much for that. And the alternative safety compliance issue that came up here back in 2010 when they reauthorized the Magnuson Act, I'm sure it seemed like a good idea at the time. We were going to come up with a new safety program in addition to the dockside program and stuff that we've all worked so well with here. And it just, first of all, none of us were paying attention, I guess, because it came at us like a freight train all of a sudden that we were going to have a whole bunch of new safety regs that we hadn't had a chance to comment on. We didn't understand the necessity of them. And thanks to you and the delegation, we've got some time here to try to figure this out with the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is not our enemy, but the Coast Guard does not understand the internal workings of our business and the economics. Just one simple thing that they had in there was the fact that we'd have to get our vessels hauled out and have the propeller shafts pulled out of them and inspected by somebody who doesn't live here. We can't afford that sort of thing. How many years has it been since somebody broke a propeller shaft? These new Aquamet 17 shafts we've got are going to outlast me, I'm pretty sure. So, anyway, thank you for that, and thank you for working on so many of these issues back there so quietly. You know, we don't hear about them very often, but we're paying attention. And the last thing was that thank you for finally, I didn't think we would ever get back to this Salt and Stahl Kennedy funding that was being used by NOAA that was supposed to be controlled by commercial fishermen. Thank you for that Commercial Fisheries Advisory Committee. And I guess you can tell I'm a fan. Thanks.
Well, these are important issues, and you're right. They don't rise to that level of making front page news across the state, but they're significant. Our ability to be able to market fish, kind of a really big deal. Again, you point out Coast Guard is not our enemy, but we need to be able to work with Coast Guard on regulations that are reasonable. And I found it somewhat ironic that, you know, when you think about what we have led on in Alaska when it comes to safety compliance within respective fleets, we've been the leader out there. And so now you've got this kind of coming at you, and yes, they did. There was 10 years notice or whatever, but then it's not unlike many things around government. You wait until the very end and just hurry up and move something through, even though it's not going to enhance safety at the end of the day. Regulation for regulation's sake. So we've had some good conversations with Coast Guard and said, it's okay if you need more time to get this right. Let's do it right. So that effort is clearly there. But you know, we're making some headway on some things. I'm still pulling out my hair with the electronic monitoring, recognizing that you've got a boat, a vessel that is as big as it is. You've got a crew. Everybody's working or they're not on the boat. And you've got not very much space. And it's not that we don't want to make sure that there is some level of observation going on. But with the technology that we use for every other thing that we do, really, you have to plant a human being there to count things and observe things. It's been very, very frustrating working with the folks at NIMS NOAA. I've mentioned this, I had long conversations with the head of NOAA, Dr. Kathy Sullivan. She's been invited now, and I've sent the invitation twice to her by a longliner out of Craig, saying, come out on my boat, and I'll just show you how this works. And she's actually an interesting woman. She's a former astronaut and really loves Alaska. And I think she would come. I'm not sure that the administration will let her. But we're going to keep working on that. You know, we got vessel discharge that we got to deal with, that extension. There's no shortage of issues within the fisheries. And what we're trying to do is make sure that the regulations that are out there are sound and reasonable and not unduly burdensome. We want to make sure you're safe. We want to make sure that we're taking care of the environment. We want to make sure we're taking care of the species. But let's make sure that the regulations work for everybody.
Well, and then with Marine Mammal Protection Act, things like that, when you are successful, you do come back, and we have whales all over.
Tell me about the whales.
And sea lions and all of this. There's no escape plan. Okay, we've done our job. We've brought them back. Let's go back to, you know, some sense of normalcy. And I mean, as a kid, you remember, I remember, it was a big deal to see a whale.
Yeah.
Now there are 100, you know, living out between here and Point Gardner. And it's exponentially, and the proof is there, the science is there, we've done a good job, and now they're still, you know, protected, and they're still, you know, we're to the point where you lose a few of them, and they could shut us down. I mean, you know, there's no escape, or there's no, okay, now there's a way out of this. And so, yeah.
This is interesting to hear this, because you know, last time I was here, and that was not too very long ago, the big discussion was the sea otter and how the population had just exploded and they were eating everything in sight. But now what I'm hearing is it's the whale that are coming in unprecedented numbers.
Well,
now you have both. So the whales haven't scared up the sea otters.
The sea otters haven't gone away. It's just that all those fishermen that were here talking to you before went broke. They're not here.
So speaking of that, for the gill netters, it's one of our big issues is the Alaska Marine Mammal Observer Program. And we had 2 years of folks observing us. And I commented on the report that wasn't a very big report, honestly. But I was wondering if you could speak to its potential, hopefully not future, of the program. Do you know what the funding is like for that?
I don't know what the funding levels look like in that account. I will take a look at it. I think we recognize that here in Alaska, we've got more of all of them when it comes to marine mammals that we're watching and are protected. And so I don't know whether the funding is up or down, but I'll look into that.
And the numbers were, you know, pretty good in the paper to say. We feel like it was kind of a waste of resources.
Well, that happens. Unfortunately. Yes.
I'm just wondering where Congress is on the Fire Act. I retired Forest Service, and I was working in the regional office. I've done budgets for lots of years. For the last few years, the process is we hope to get our budget by January, February, and then by May, we're scrambling to put millions of dollars up to help protect with the fire resources down south. I mean, the Tongass is, as you know, is a nice temperate rainforest. We don't have that much of a fire issue down here, but we, as a region, we're putting up millions of dollars annually. And it's getting tougher now as we're forcing ourselves into, if we want work done, we need to find partnerships. And trying to line up partnerships in that small window and having it allocated in that time is more difficult as that money's being taken away, too. So helping the agency with some standard flow of budgets and some stability would be good. And part of that, of course, is, you know, the escalation and the amount of money that goes to fire protection throughout the whole Pacific Northwest. So just wondering where that is.
Well, I think I can offer good news on this front because you've outlined the situation that we have been in. As we have seen growing numbers of fires around the country. Alaska had this our second worst fire season last year. There's significant fires, of course, burning in the lower 48 now. Those fire suppression dollars are just on a trajectory that's just almost straight up. And what has happened is in an effort to cover the fire suppression costs, because you got to pay for it, is the other accounts within Forest Service, whether the accounts that would deal with thinning or prevention, but also like the recreational accounts, all of the accounts within Forest Service are raided then to pay for the fires that have happened. And so you've outlined the very frustrating process that those within the agency then are dealt with. What we have done, we've actually introduced a legislation, bipartisan legislation. I led it with Senator Wyden from Oregon and the two senators from Idaho. And it effectively ends this practice of what we call fire borrowing. So we set up a structure that says we will fund 100% of the 10-year average, and if the fires that season are above and beyond that, that would be deemed emergency funding that you wouldn't take from other fire resource accounts. If it's a low fire year and we don't use all of the 100% of the 10-year average, then those funds can be directed into other accounts, for instance, in the prevention, in the thinning, in the management end of it. So we effectively end the fire borrowing. What we see here in the Tongass is, I'm going to be going to Wrangell and talking with folks tomorrow at a meeting just like this, and I know for a fact that I'm going to be hearing from them saying, we can't get permits from Forest Service to go up to Ann Ann for bear viewing because the Forest Service folks there say, we don't have staffing to be able to do this because in our recreation accounts we just don't have the money. So we have I have Forest Service within my Interior Appropriations bill. We plussed up and we've actually directed Forest Service because we have been on the skinny end of the recreation accounts within the Forest Service, and yet within our forests here in the Tongass and the Chugach we have as much as anybody when it comes to the recreation opportunities. So we're on a more positive side of the ledger there. But when you think about the responsibility the Forest Service has to manage for multiple use, it's not only things like timber harvest, but it is the other recreational uses. But if you've used up all of your money in fire suppression elsewhere around the country, and you don't have the ability for Forest Service to do the rest of its job as a multiple-use manager, it makes it pretty tough. So I'm optimistic because the administration is supportive of a fix. We have bipartisan support in the Senate, and I think that we can get it in the House as well. So hopefully we will see an end to the trajectory that we've been dealing with, which is really limiting. We're always able to get our fire suppression monies in Alaska, even in really hard years like last year, because our fire season is earlier than anybody else's, so we get paid first. Lucky for us. But it just doesn't even out the books with the process that we have. So we're working on that. We have time for probably one more question, and then so I'm gonna let you. How about somebody over here? Oh, well, all right, maybe. Yes.
Just your thoughts on healthcare reform and where it might be going. You know, working at the hospital, of course, to have a strong economy and a strong city of Petersburg, the hospital is a vital part of that. And critical access hospitals really are safety nets for small rural communities. And keeping the critical access designation is very important to us. And also, you know, just a little question about we're getting more and more regulatory requirements and that we have to have staff to do that. We know healthcare is just continuing to increase. And for the hospital, we're getting less and less reimbursement, so it gets harder and harder. So I'm just wondering with maybe the change in election or if you see anything coming down the pike about making sure that our hospital continues to be solvent and vibrant. But the other critical access hospitals throughout the whole country are facing this issue.
Yeah, they are. They are. Petersburg is not alone. Those smaller hospitals are critical access hospitals around the state, and there are a good handful of them, are hurting. And what you have happening is, again, a level of regulation that came with the Affordable Care Act in an effort to pay for some of that. So you're seeing that as this small community hospital. Not unlike what a big Seattle hospital would be facing, but again, they got the staff to deal with it. They've got the revenue to come in because they've got a client base, a patient base that you simply don't have here. So again, when you're trying to kind of stuff everybody into that same small box here, there are going to be those who really will feel the weight. What we've done with the Affordable Care Act. We've worked to provide insurance, but we haven't made the cost of care any less expensive. And this is what we have to reform. This is what we've got to do. You know, there have been numerous attempts to repeal the ACA, and I supported the repeal because I didn't think we had made anything more affordable when it came to healthcare. What we're doing is we're requiring you to have insurance. I don't know about you, but my insurance is not less expensive, it's more expensive. We're celebrating the fact that this next year, the increase for Premera coverage is only going to increase by 10%. Last year, it increased by 38%. So, you know, this is not necessarily reason to celebrate, in my view. We have made some efforts, I think, to save from some of the really negative impacts. When I'm visited in my office by council members and mayors and communities around the state or school districts, I'm saying, okay, what's the problem in your school? What's the problem in your town? And they're saying healthcare. They're saying the healthcare costs that are associated, you know, the big scary one was going to be the impact of the Cadillac tax. And it was coming to the communities, it was coming to the school districts, it was coming to the unions, it was coming to everybody. Well, we didn't get it eliminated, but we did get it delayed, so that gives some breathing room there. But that was when the Ketchikan School District came to visit me, they said that was their number one concern. Because they had no idea how they were going to cover it. And they reminded me, and they said, by the way, this doesn't deliver better education to the kids in Ketchikan, and we're not sure that it's giving us better care. So in my view, we have much to do to to do what the ACA promised, which was to make the care more affordable. So I think what you're seeing play out in the politics of the nation right now, as you have some of the exchanges that are collapsing, states that are seeing what we're seeing, where you just have more of your insurers pulling out. We're down to one now on the individual exchange, and that's Premier. That's not competition. And so I think you will see things come to a head yet one more time, where, again, it's not focusing on getting insurance. The focus should be on reducing that cost of care. And I think that one of the ways that you do that is you make sure that at your local level, those facilities that can provide that care that is less expensive. I'm a big believer in community health centers. I'm a big believer in making sure that where we're providing for that that viability at that local level. And so we've got a lot to do, but our critical access hospitals, these small ones in these communities out here, you're at risk. I think you know that. Well, we've done pretty good. We covered healthcare, fishery, transportation, transboundary, landless. We've hit a few of the good issues. So I thank you for the exchange that we have. One of the biggest challenges that I have in representing the most amazing state in the country is Alaska's big. And it's a challenge to get around. And I look at all the places that I want to be and I need to be, and I'm kind of at the mercy of Alaska Airlines. But it is good for me to come back and be on a dock and to smell the good red air of Southeast and just be reminded of how blessed I am to call this great place home. So thank you for that privilege and that honor. I appreciate it.
Well, my cohort in crime here, Julianne, just wanted me to remind you there's signs and buttons and bumper stickers and all the good stuff that we got a campaign for our gal here. So thank you all.
16th of August.
16th of August, right. It's the primary. And so get out and vote. And oh, yes, we have absentee ballots. So, anyway, thank you so much for coming, and grab some grub on the way out. Nobody needs to cook tonight.
No, go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.